Well...
Well, tell me what it's all about.
Well, Mr. Bernard thought that I hadn't really... I'd been having trouble getting a topic for my rare books course, and he suggested that I do special collections, since I was going to special collections. Just seemed like a good idea. And so what I'm doing is I'm holding a series of interviews with people who were involved with the university at the time that special collections developed, and before special collections developed, when there wasn't any place for the books, and asking them if they can recall anything in particular. I have the minutes and the history on paper, but what I'm looking for is interesting comments about the way rare books came to the library, anybody who was involved in the planning of the special collections, why it was done the way it was done, any anecdotes about donors, that sort of thing. And I know you were at the library between 1947 and 1962, that you probably were very much involved in some of the planning for the future.
Well, where should we begin?
Well, let's begin your experiences when you were acting head of the university. Did you have any particular feelings about the rare book sections or any special things being a part, or did you feel anything needed to be done at that time?
Well, the Special Collections Division was established before I became acting librarian, and this was really very much Neil Harlow's own baby. I don't know if you realize that he had been, I suppose, the founder of the Special Collections Division at UCLA before he got here. This was at least one of his jobs. And before that, had been associated with the Bancroft Library of California and the State Library at Sacramento. So this was a very deep interest of his. And in fact, the concept itself was fairly new. The idea of having a division of special collections as distinguished from simply a treasure room, and there was a distinction. Libraries had always had treasure rooms if they had treasures. This was common enough. But the concept was relatively narrow then. That is to say, these were essentially valuable materials that had to be restricted, limited in some way from general use because of their value. Now, special collections, in Neil's concept, went beyond that. It went on to include anything that required special treatment, really. So such things as materials too small, too fragile, manuscripts, material that was in some way to be limited so far as the general public was concerned. For example, our How We Read room, How We Read materials, anything of this sort was to come there, and this was to provide then a base for anything that required special treatment. So it represented a step beyond the treasure room, and also it wasn't to be merely custodial. The custody was an important part of it. We went to what seemed then elaborate measures to provide for air conditioning and the like, but it wasn't merely to be custodial, it was also to be really a center for advanced work. These were to be, if you will, in some part the distinguished collections of the university, and an important part of special collections was that this would provide a place for those materials largely acquired by gift, which were by provision of the donor or by reason of the librarian's view of needs, to be kept together rather than dispersed through the entire collection, so that a Murray collection, for example, has some value and standing as a collection, and that would have been lost had the Murray books been dispersed through the entire stack. So it was to pull all these considerations together and to provide, along with the facilities themselves, staff who could offer an advanced reference service in connection with them, that special collections came into being. There was also a suggestion at the time, which really didn't develop very far, of this serving as the university archive. It was to serve as the university archive, and we made some efforts, largely abortive, to get the archival materials in. Well, what we got, for the most part, we didn't want, and what we wanted, for the most part, we didn't get. But it was also to serve in that capacity for the university. So there were a variety of interests, a variety of uses, and it was to be active and not simply an equivalent of what we had before, a certain section of the stacks locked away. Conversely, Lorinda, some of the materials that did belong formerly in the closed off, locked up portion of the stacks, we always called it the cage, were removed and never got into special collections at all. And these were rather amusing. I remember, was it I and some other people? Is this operating all right?
Mm-hmm.
Who were involved in making some survey of the materials that had accumulated in the cage. And they're really, really rather an odd lot indeed. I think the cage had begun as a place to put rare materials and gradually got to encompass materials that people thought might somehow or other be stolen from the stacks. And in those days, of either undue sensitivity on the part of the staff or undue ignorance on the part of the students, all sorts of things that were thought to have some presumed erotic interest.
I noticed in the
got into
minutes.
The cage.
Somebody saying that they didn't think Freud should be
well,
the open shelf.
For the most part, this wasn't due to an excessive censorship on the part of the library staff. I'm reasonably safe in saying this. It was due to the ignorance of the students. What would typically happen is something like this. Some student or other would read, say, Studs Lonergan, which was then considered a hot book. And the silly kids would then presume that all of Farrell must be equally attractive, lewd, lugubrious, etc., etc. And they would pinch all of Farrell, you know. Not only would they pinch Studs Lonergan, which I could understand, but the dodos would pinch all the other works of Farrell. So if you looked there, you saw the most wonderful collection. You'd find all of Farrell, you'd find all of James Joyce, you'd find all of, I think all of James Branch Cabell was in there, and so on. The endless works, Freud in the same way, and so on. And we'd really gotten together a wonderfully silly collection. As I said, for the most part, to protect them from loss, because they were being stolen by students for the wrong reasons. But we really, I think at the time, had a choice of alternatives. Either put a label in the book saying, despite what you may think, this is not sexy and don't steal it, or lock it up. Well, both were rather silly, but at any rate, we got rid of all these when Special Collections was established, and indeed, I don't know, I suppose it did come to house the erotica, or what was considered erotica in that day. But there never was really very much of this, so far as I know, and we never had the equivalent of an enfer, the Bibliothèque Nationale, or the like. What we had was accumulated on an entirely happenstance basis, and for the most part, by miscalculation, occasionally something would turn out to be.
So you actually helped with a physical sort of transferring of a good many
books
and choosing the books. And
then another thing, the reverse process went on. I can't remember now who did this, but I should think that it may have been Basil Stewart Stubbs for the most part. But we also knew and then proceeded to do something about it. We knew that there were in the stacks all sorts of things which ought not to be there, material that was genuinely scarce and rare, first editions of many of the important literary works, rare editions of historical materials, Canadiana that certainly could not be replaced and that might better have gone into safekeeping. And so some attempt was made to rescue these, and I can recall that we had some guidelines drawn up, mostly stolen from other libraries, as to what constituted rare materials, and we tried to remove these from the stacks. This is a very interesting task.
I wonder if it's still going on.
I don't know.
I noticed some very rare Canadiana items in the stacks that I've used for a project I was doing.
Well, it needs to be done. It needs to be done constantly, and the guidelines have to be revised because estimates tend to change. Mm-hmm. Estimates of scarcity change with the years. For example, we used to affix certain dates as representing early printing for, let's say, Canadian provinces or American states or anything, say, before 1700 for Great Britain. But of course, this changes, and I think perhaps where we might have said that the one date was a cutoff line, then something else would be judged as appropriate now. And the same thing is true of types of materials. For example, libraries now are concerned in a way they used not to be with early editions of works in the sciences. And so this needs to go on constantly. Whether it still does, I don't know. Conversely, what we did do was attempt to secure working copies, additional copies, mm-hmm. or equivalent suitable alternatives for the materials that we took out of the stacks and provided for the students. The main thrust came in respect of Canadiana, where we felt that it was our obligation to preserve the resources for future generations of scholars, and at the same time there was heavy demand always from students here for material for essays, so you could hardly, so to speak, just remove stuff from the stacks into an area where the run of students could not get at it without doing something to make up for it. So that was one of the interesting aspects of special collections.
How about the friends? Did they were you connected much with the friends?
Yes, I
haven't heard much. Have they dissolved a bit?
I think they never did materialize in quite the way hoped for. If you asked me, the friends turned out to be very largely Walter Kerner and H.R. McQuillan, and to a lesser extent Leon Kerner, much lesser extent, but Walter Kerner for the most part. Some money was received by way of donations and grants, and we had hoped, I think, to do more to get more from the friends than it turned out to be, and the record is deceiving. The Walter Kerner's gifts, for example, were generally credited to the friends, but in point of fact, they were really personal. They were one man's interests, and an interest that had been there before the establishment of the Friends. We couldn't claim that the Friends had somehow or other sparked or increased this interest. No, the Friends really didn't ever work out, and Neil Harlow worked very hard at this. We used to issue publications. You may have seen copies of the footnotes and so on. And we had meetings. A number of loyal people rallied around each time. Probably the most important, most active person in promoting the organization, other than Neil Harlow himself, was Dr. Wallace Wilson and Ethel Wilson. And they worked hard and very loyally indeed, but we never managed to expand the group appreciably from its beginnings. Nor, I think, were we able to convert the Friends into the other hope that had been held, and that was to serve as a kind of society of bookmen for the Vancouver community. We had some high hopes that it would do this, a kind of center or gathering point for people not necessarily with money or collections to give, or at least not immediately. We always had some ulterior motives. But simply as a place for collectors, people interested in books to come together. But I don't think it really worked out. Disappointment on the whole question.
Did any collections come the way of the library while you were involved? I mean, any major collections?
Yes, the two that, I should say, perhaps more than two. Let me begin with the two that remain most vivid in my memory, and then I'll perhaps go on to some of the others. These two were rather romantic affairs, as it turned out. One was a Poupon collection materials relating to China. You may sometimes hear this referred to as a Macau collection as well.
Macau collection.
Yes. And the other was the Murray collection, both essentially gifts of Walter Kerner, though I am not sure now.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Well, the Murray collection certainly was, and the Poupon, I can't remember whether Walter Kerner paid for it himself or got the university to put up the money, but I suspect he paid for it.
Really?
Yeah. You will find a good description of the Poupon collection written up by Dr. Who was it? Sorry, the name escapes me now. Not Peter Hull, who was responsible for getting here, but his associate here, Y.T. Wong. Y.T. Wong. Y.T. we call him. Well, the Poupon collection involved a trip by Ping Ti Ho, or Peter, as we called him, to Macau, where the collection was held. It had apparently been smuggled out of China at some serious risks, and held there, and Dr. Ho went to inspect it, and of course this was not your ordinary kind of book evaluation. It involved a good deal of elaborate protocol with many lavish dinners and so on. At any rate, it finally did come to us, and fun and dismay it caused us as we unpacked these huge crates and realized, I guess for the first time in our library lives, that we were absolutely incompetent to deal with the material. We didn't know what it was, whether it was upside down, right? We had no clue, you know. We were used to handling it as paper. Of course, we got Dr. Wong and Dr. Ho and others to help us, but I can still recall my own sense of consternation as I realized that this was clean beyond my library ken, and there was nothing really that I could do about this. A very important collection, probably I should say in terms of international distinction, the most important we've ever received. The acquisition of the Poupon collection at once shot us into the front rank of research libraries on the continent in respect of Orientalia, with a number of very important rarities, including some specimens of early printing from blocks, and might take a look at it sometime.
Of course.
Some gorgeous things, some gorgeous bindings. Well worth spending your time. Some enormously lavish volumes representing the treasures of the Imperial Palace in Peking and so on. beautiful things.
Is it housed? It's not housed in special collections.
No, it isn't. In effect, the Asian Studies Division was created to around it.
Very good.
It couldn't really be housed in special collections because you have to have somebody who knows what it is, and we're just not competent to deal with it. Take a look at it sometime. As I say, the initial dismay gave way to awe as some of the things were identified and others were immediately visible. You only had to handle and look at some of the things to know what we have there. And quite aside from the matter of rarities in the sense of early printing and illustration and the like, apparently of great importance, research importance, particularly with reference to certain provinces of China and so on. I've forgotten now which ones. Generally the southwest area, if I remember rightly. This was probably the coup, and I suppose nothing since has quite matched it, though perhaps the Sinclair collection that we got with the Macmillan funds later on might come fairly close, but I don't think so. Of course, an enormous bargain for us in retrospect. I think it cost around $60,000 or so. And,
seemed expensive at the time.
Yeah, well, this brings me to my next point. $60,000 or $80,000 or whatever it was, but it certainly wasn't $100,000. And I think $60,000 is about right. Seemed such an unworldly figure to us at the time. We just had never had any experience at UBC of dealing with these amounts. Years of penury had limited our sights. And it was commonplace, if you'll take a look through the minutes of the Library Committee, to have decisions of the Library Committee with respect to the purchase of materials, well, I don't know. Originally, I think it was anything over $25 had to be authorized by the Library Committee, and subsequently perhaps a figure of 100 or so or 200. But the idea of buying something that was several thousand dollars worth, I can remember, you know, the purchase of something like Means Patrologia. This is a printing of the works of the early Christian fathers, or the large German set, Monumenta Germaniae Historica. I think this was about $6,000 or $7,000. These represented campaigns to us. One didn't buy this. One worked hard at one, tried to interest the university in making some special efforts. So acquisitions of this scale, as I say, were quite beyond our ken. Now I'll come to the part that is really, I suppose, unpublishable. And
shall I turn it off?
You may have to excise this. But the Murray collection, which was a collection formed by a bookseller in Montreal, included not only his regular stock, so to speak, but the rarer items he had accumulated. In fact, it was not by any means comprised of Canadiana entirely, though the Canadiana were the best of it. The Murray collection had been coming up for sale, and we knew about it, but of course we really didn't spend much time thinking about it because it was so obviously beyond our reach. And I can recall Walter Kerner coming into the librarian's office, as he often did, most interested personally, not your kind of donor who does it as a matter of just sort of generalized benevolence or prestige or what have you. He is fascinated by books. Taking Walter Kerner around the library was always a delight and a chore because he'd stop and look at everything. Well, Walter Kerner was in the office, and Neil Harlow and I were chatting, as we always did with him, about the need for library development. This was a perennial theme, and I forget whether it was Neil or myself, probably Neil, who indicated in the normal wistful and, as I say, quite impractical motive. Neil Harlow was saying, well, here's the Murray collection that's available, and this is indicative of the sort of thing one would like to do if one had the means. This is the way you build up distinguished collections. You buy up a collection, and at one fell swoop you have something that is going to advance the library several stages in its resources, the sort of thing that brings scholars to you. And he mentioned the Murray collection, and it was available in Montreal, that we weren't, of course, thinking about it. Well, Walter Kerner is no man to just sit back and muse. He said, oh, this is available in Montreal, what are they asking for it? I think we said somewhere around $60,000. His next question to Neil and myself, is it worth the money? We'd had the listing, to say we had been rather amusing ourselves by longing after it. And I can still remember so very vividly Neil and myself turning to each other with blank looks. We had never been asked to make a decision of this kind as a collection of $60,000 worth $60,000. It was well beyond our capacity, but we both gulped bravely, looked at each other, and nodded our heads. We thought it was worth it. Well, immediately Walter Kerner says, fine, if you think it's worth it, let's get going on this. And he picks up the phone and says, get me Carl Goldenberg, his lawyer, in Montreal. And this was it, while Neil and I were, quivering inside, wondering whether we'd made some ghastly error in our estimate or not. But this was my first and probably really my last experience at this kind of scale of buying, and it came to us, and in the retrospect proved a wonderful buy for the university. We not only got all kinds of valuable materials for ourselves, but in the long run, I think we were able, by sale of duplicates and so on, to get back a substantial amount of the money, which I think was part of the provisos. This troubled us too, but at any rate, it proved, as almost any purchase made at that date would have proved, it wasn't a matter of foresight or on our part. It's just that prices have gone up so very much since, but it proved to be a first-rate acquisition for the
tremendous
library. Yes. Yeah.
What do you think about having them? A complete unity of the, say, the Asian Study Collection, the Colbeck Collection, and Special Collection. Any value, or is it better to have it the way it is, all over? And the Woodward Collection. I mean, is there any point to having a great general place, or is there some?
I don't think that's a difficult matter, really. It depends approximately on the kind of facilities you have available. Dispersal is probably preferable. Put the materials where A, they will be more readily accessible to the people who want to use them, and clearly say the Woodward Historical Collection is much better placed near the Woodward clientele than here. And B, undoubtedly these collections have a greater degree of identity. They're better known if they have their own locales. The problem is whether anything short of placement in special collections will assure the security, the proper treatment of air, the proper services. Can you afford to have somebody there full time to provide the reference services and so on? So these are the conditions that have to be met. If you can meet those two conditions, I see nothing wrong with dispersal, especially when they're as highly specialized as this. Now, I would take this view back, if you referred to something, let's say, in the field of English, in the field of Canadiana or the like, where we already have considerable resources in
The razor sticks and cry, and I follow my friend. How did he come to play the fiddle for the drum? You say I have turned like the enemy, but I can remember all the things you are.
You should turn it off then if you don't want it recording. You see what I mean?
Well, I was just trying to find out how to do it.
I get confused. Hello, Pooh.
I'll turn it off now.
What?
If I sound like that, I don't think I would ever speak again.
Probably, yeah.
You know, I haven't seen a group of them. And I can't remember in the past having ever seen a group as attractive as this one. Do you suppose they made a sort of extra effort?
No, it's just that.
Or is this a group that's in good health and knows how to wash their hair?
No, you're just by contrast.
Oh, you mean I've got sort of self-trust into the lower level that just ordinary sort of nice, shiny, clean kids
right.
Look better?
Okay.
Oh, you're no, I don't think that's what you really think.
Yes, that, you know, all daddies talk about there are fewer hippies on campus, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's nonsense. There are not fewer long hairs on campus. It's just that there are more people with long hair, so that the ones with the, you know, right down to their waist sort of stand out, and there are only about four or five boys with hair that long.
Yeah,
but the standard is lower. That's why.
Max, our standard is lower.
Or different.
We're just so glad to see people looking at it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I thought this was one of the most alert, attractive. Of course, I
couldn't figure out what it was. And over the tape recorder, Mrs. Daniels says, My teeth. And then there's a sort of general sort of program of everybody breaking up.
Ah, dear.
Is your husband taking part tonight, too?
I think he has to... Oh, I put that out of order. Right. Wait a minute. I hate mechanical details, but they're necessary.
Well, it depends really on the degree of distinctiveness that these collections have. Now, the Kolbeck collection, one might make a rather good case for housing in the special collections department, because we have other similar materials there, and in a way the segregation makes it more difficult for people to get a conspectus of the resources. If we got in, well, let's take the Murray collection, to have housed that separately from the Howie Reed, the A.J. Taylor and the other Canadiana materials we had would have been a disservice to the researcher. So this needs to be taken into account. Otherwise, I think dispersal is reasonable enough. Now, what you do get very frequently in the university, and I suppose this isn't really part of your theme at all, is the strong wish of the donor to keep his particular gift together even when it has no particular distinctiveness, and in some cases, no special value even. As a collection, that is, the materials there don't represent anything substantially different than what you already have in the stacks. And I won't go into this now, but I fought, and I guess won or lost, I'm not sure yet which, a long battle about one such case where the donor wanted to give us his books on condition that they be kept in a separate room and treated as a special collection, and frankly they weren't worth it. This would have been a drain on the library in respect of servicing and other considerations, and would have been a disservice to the university community. Would have meant nothing more than a kind of memorializing of the donor, and my feeling was, let's offer him a plaque, but not a springs, as we call it, collection, where there are strings attached. But in the case of a Woodward, I think clearly it ought not to be here. It ought to be with the other medical materials.
Do you think that there are many potential donors in Vancouver of rare books? This is the sort of thing that's chased after by the library, or do they wait for people to come to them?
I probably can't speak with any great confidence on this because I've tended to lose touch with these people when leaving the library. My guess is that Vancouver is not yet a book-rich community, not in the sense of collections of distinction. And I'm inclined to believe that, by and large, our relations with potential donors in Vancouver may well be what they were. That is, one of potential embarrassment rather than of joy. I mean by that that in my day, most of what was offered tended to be fairly humdrum, nondescript materials, and you were hard pressed to it to find a graceful way of saying no or of taking them and utilizing them for the everyday purposes, but somehow or other not offending the donor's feelings by doing this. It took laborious explanation on our part to indicate that we would be glad to have the gifts, but wanted to be allowed to do as we pleased with them.
Right.
And a great deal of material used to come in the back door, and if we had our way out the back door very promptly thereafter. Now, one needs a great deal of care in these proceedings because you don't want to offend people who are generous and mean well. This is common courtesy, and in the more practical sense, one doesn't want to offend someone who may be giving you something very much worthwhile afterward, or where the example of refusal might tend to alienate somebody else, by virtue of its becoming known, somebody else who would give you something substantial. So it requires delicacy and so on. But by and large, I think there are no great plums to be had locally. And in point of fact, I don't think I've heard of anything of the sort coming in since my day. I don't think this has changed very much since I had contact with it. I used to enjoy these trips, these visits very much, and it's always interesting to see the people, and one caught a glimpse of all sorts of insights of human nature.
Time, or do you have a few minutes more? Or
I think perhaps, Lorinda, I might leave now because I've got a meeting at 1 and I've got to get some lunch before, but I'd be glad to continue with you at some time after, let's say, 2:30.
I have 26 young students coming in for dinner tonight, and so I'm more or less have to go home. But I hadn't too much else to ask you. Were you involved at all in the Burns collection?
Yes, I was. Yes,
yes.
This took place during my day, as a matter of fact.
Another little talk if you had time.
Another
interesting
one, of course, is the several other interesting collections that came our way. The Malcolm Lowry collection was...
Which one?
The Malcolm Lowry collection.
Oh, yes, yes.
Though on that one, Basil Stewart Stubbs can give you far more information than I can, since he was very intimately connected with it afterwards. But that was an interesting transaction with Earl Burney and Mrs. Lowry involved. And the Burns one we bought in my time. The recall that one I know something about, though wasn't directly involved in. I suppose that should rate with the Murray and Poupon ones and the Howie Reed as being the most distinguished collections we have acquired. I have made a mistake. I'm not deducing it before. I'm not quite sure. The collections in the Woodward Library, I know of them by name, but just what the dimensions, for example, of the Sinclair collection were, of the one that we purchased from Dr. Chauncey, forgotten the name, eminent medical historian, Leek, Chauncey Leek. These may very well be of the same caliber and importance, but I'm not as familiar with them.
Perhaps if you had a minute on Tuesday, I could just ask you very quickly one or two other questions.
Serve, or any time Tuesday afternoon after about 2:30 again.
Very good. Yes, that's just fine. I'm going to be talking to Mrs. Yan.
And I go right back to Edna Trunk Road.